You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
I did. I really got convinced to do it by the press because I had already written about half of it in the form of magazine articles. So they said, well, just keep going, you know, and so I did, and I finished that one, and that one has sold very well. It's in its third printing, so it's considered to be, by the University of Minnesota Press, a bestseller. And, of course, the magazines kept asking me to write more articles, and I kept doing that, and then they came to me a few years ago and said, well, you know, you're already halfway to your second book. Why don't you just keep going? And so, all right. So that's really how both these books occurred. I've been telling David, you know, I didn't know that I was going to end up being his chronicler in writing about every single building he ever designed, but it looks like that's my fate. But fortunately, he's a terrific person as well as a really great architect, which makes it a lot easier for me to write about him because I so enjoy his personality and being with him and visiting his work. This book is pretty much the same format as the first book, same number of pages and size, although that one is all black, and so we decided this one had to be basically kind of white. I think the work in this book is stronger. The first book really showed his work all the way back to when he first started. And as true with most creative people, you know, you start out a little slow, you know, maybe initially you're tentative a little bit. And so I think some of the work in the first book is a little tentative and it got stronger as it went. And he's now 60 years old and he's really at his peak. And I think everything in this book is really extraordinary. There's really not a bad project or a weak project in it. So it's fun to see a creative person really kind of at his stride and doing such terrific work. It's interesting with the title, The Invisible Element of Place. One of the things I have the hardest time doing as a writer is coming up with titles, and didn't know exactly what I would call this book. And then David one day showed me a letter that he got from a professor, Ryan Vine, who teaches English at the College of St. Scholastica up in Duluth. And apparently Professor Vine lives near where David lives and would drive past his buildings all the time and sent David a letter just saying how much he admired the work and sent enclosed with it a poem by Wallace Stevens. And I'll read you the poem. It's really short, and it's how I figured out what the title was going to be. The poem is called Anecdote of Men by the Thousand. And I used to live in Hartford, Connecticut, a few blocks away from where Wallace Stevens used to live, so there was this kind of interesting connection there as well. Anyway, the poem goes, "The soul," he said, "is composed of the external world. There are men of the East," he said, "who are the East. There are men of a province who are that province. There are men of a valley who are that valley. These are men whose words are as natural sounds of their places, as the cackle of toucans in the place of toucans. The mandolin is the instrument of a place. Are there mandolins of western mountains? Are there mandolins of northern moonlight? The dress of a woman of Lhasa in its place is an invisible element of that place, made visible." And so this idea, that last line, an invisible element of place, struck me as something that was very true of David's work, that what artists do, certainly in this case what architects do, is they make the sort of invisible qualities of a place visible to us through their work, and they literally make the place through their buildings. And so I decided to call it The Invisible Element of Place, and I think a lot of the work shows how David Somala is really just incredibly skilled at drawing out the qualities of places and of the people he works with, and makes them, you know, kind of unforgettable. So what I thought, since we're a relatively small group and since I don't have any slides, I thought we'd do sort of like story hour here. And I thought I would hold up some pages just to give you a sense of some of the work. I divided the work into four groups. So he's done buildings that are sort of like boxes. He's done buildings that are more traditional gable roof buildings, houses. He's done some buildings that have what we call shed roofs, so they just have the slope in one direction. And then he's done a group of projects that are really whole communities, so clusters, as I call them. So the and one of the things that I try to do in the book is to talk about how architecture is a reflection of how we live and what we value, and it's really a mirror to life. We all live in houses. We all work in buildings. Architecture is this pervasive thing in our lives that is often invisible to all of us because we spend most of our lives in it, and so we don't see it anymore. So part of my task as a writer about architecture is to help people see what's all around them and to see it in new ways. So this first house was for the contractor who builds a lot of David's buildings in the Twin Cities, Kevin Streeter. Kevin Streeter is divorced and had an older teenage son. So David had to design a house for a father and son. And as I talk about Turgenev's book, Fathers and Sons, and the classic kinds of tensions that can exist between fathers and sons in the same way that there are tensions between sometimes mothers and daughters. So there are two boxes. One is for dad and one is for son. The son is almost exactly the same. These are the two bedrooms as the father's, but slightly smaller. It's 2 feet smaller in every dimension, otherwise totally identical. So the dad gets the slightly bigger bedroom and the son gets the slightly smaller one. But you wouldn't notice. I mean, it's this kind of... David has a lot of sort of jokes in his buildings, you know, like making the one slice. And then, of course, the base, they come down these stairs and they come to the common space. So it sits out on a wetland in the western suburbs has these outdoor porches behind this sort of white wood slat screen. And so they look very mysterious because especially at night they kind of glow and you're not sure what it is because you actually don't see any windows. But there are porches behind here and they're almost zen-like spaces. Let me get show you a photo of what it's like to be in the... Oh, I thought there was a photo in here. Oh, there it is. It's kind of small, but you can see that you are in this kind of amazing white space where the trees are sort of visible but not. And then these are the stairs that come down. So the two stairs come down from each bedroom and face each other, kind of in confrontation. And then there's, here are the two stairs, and then, you know, there's couches right across from each other. So you can imagine the father and son kind of discussing matters. And then, you know, the father likes motorcycles, so he has this big garage, and he made the windows of the garage like big portals, which I realize are like the headlamps of the motorcycles, you know, writ large. So, and the other thing that David likes to do is even when doing a house, he likes to make the house into a compound. So he took this house, and there's the mandatory sauna. Whether you want one or not, you're going to get a sauna with David. And so he makes that a separate little building. And so it forms this courtyard. So you come through from the front and you enter, you enter the house through under one of the boxes and you come in here and then there's this wonderful sort of auto court, which I discovered why. I mean, this is again, how understanding the client. Kevin Streeter not only likes to ride motorcycles, but he has like a big gang of people who he likes to ride motorcycles with. So I was there once and there was, I don't know, maybe 25 motorcycles in this auto court. You know, they were all getting ready to go out on some journey. So you realize that what looks idiosyncratic in David's work is often because there's a reason for it. So that gives you a sense of, you know, how he takes what a client needs and what the client's life is like, and he makes this kind of magical place for the client. And as Kevin, who said, you know, he doesn't even particularly like to leave his house. He just so enjoys just kind of being there all the time, which I think is probably the greatest compliment that an architect can have. Sometimes David, most of his buildings are houses, but not all of them. He actually did a factory building in Duluth for a company that makes the siding, the dark siding that he likes to use on houses. And it's a recycled material. And so he basically did the offices, and he, of course, used a lot of their materials. So the floor and the furniture and the walls and everything is made of the company's materials so that they can show off their product. And then you go down some stairs, and they're actually making it all below you. But it's this big, like, checkerboard floor pattern there. So and they overlook Duluth Harbor. And again, you know, this idea that you make a building that is about what the owner is about is another aspect to his work. You know, one of the great things about writing these books is you have these incredible memories of when you went to visit them. And I actually visited this house, the Krismer house, with my wife and my mother. And we were visiting up on Washington Island, and this is close to Washington Island in Wisconsin. And we come through the woods here, and Alice Krismer is a violinist. And so you hear this kind of wonderful violin going, you know, she's playing away. And we just kind of sat outside and listened for a while before we even went in, because there was, Goethe once said that architecture is frozen music. And so there's somehow this sort of the qualities of music sort of coming up through the trees in this wonderful house, which is way back in the woods, had this magical quality to it. And sure enough, when I talked to Bob and Alice Krismer about the house, she talked about how she had a favorite poem by Longfellow called Evangeline, which talks the beginning. I use the beginning of the poem, opening the piece. Longfellow starts the poem by saying, "This is the forest primeval, the murmuring pines and hemlocks, bearded with moss, and in garments green, indistinct in the twilight, stand like druids of eld with voices sad and prophetic." And so this house sits in this huge pine forest and has this kind of almost sort of magical, poetic quality of that was captured in that Longfellow poem. And so I talk about how David sort of brings the wood inside. So the whole inside of this house is woods, as if the big trees outside just got converted and sawn and turned into its own kind of forest on the inside. So everything is this kind of glowing wood interior. There are other cases where, architects will have clients who don't know that they want the architect to be to work for them. So this was Mike Ryan and his wife, Pam. He's an investment banker in Chicago. And, you know, they had a little bit of spare change, so they bought, I don't know how many thousands of acres, and bought a lake in Wisconsin just as a retreat. And they had there was an old cabin, and they had David sort of look at the old cabin, and he said, "Well, what you need is a screen porch." So he builds this two-story screen porch. And then they realized, well, then once we had that, then they needed a guest house. So then he builds the guest house. And then they needed a garage. So this whole compound got built sort of serially. Every time they needed something else, he kept doing it. But I talk in this case about the building is very loft-like in the role that art and artists have have played in the way in which we now think about how we want to live. So you have all these condos in the downtown where everyone has concrete floors and you know, kind of exposed structure, the kinds of environments that artists used to like to paint in. And now that's sort of cool for everybody to live like an artist. And I talk about that because it's really clear. I mean, here's a couple that have a lot of money. They didn't have to live in a loft-like house, but it has all of those qualities of, you know, that Pam, with as a painter, has. So these are all little stories. They're stories about people and about what leads them to do what they do. Sometimes the buildings themselves are really little. So Kevin Streeter, the fellow who lives in the house I first showed, I mean, he's a contractor, so he needed a contractor's trailer. So, of course, David had to design the construction trailer for Kevin Streeter that looks kind of like Kevin's house. So it's literally a little tiny trailer. With black and the kind of white scrim over the windows, just like Kevin's house. So he like carries his house with him to the construction sites. One of the things that I think is true of David Salmela is I think he has won more national awards for tiny little buildings than almost anybody. I mean, he won a national AIA award for a sauna that is about as big as the space we're in here. And I don't think anybody has won a national design award for something that small. And I think that's one of the things that I really admire about him, is that there's a tendency for people to think that, well, architects are expensive and you only go to an architect if you're really rich and they all want to do big elaborate buildings. And what's great about David is he does really cheap buildings. I mean, really cheap. And he'll do a sauna for you if that's what you want. And so he's really shown that good design is good design at whatever price and for anybody. And literally anybody can afford a David Salmela house if they so choose. Here's an example, the Keels. He did this cabin for them. And they're a kind of middle-class couple in the Twin Cities suburbs and had this land. And what Mr. Keel had done is he had gone to window auctions and bought all the windows for the cabin ahead of time. So he hires David to do his cabin and said, oh, by the way, I already have all the windows. Well, he had all kinds of weird windows. I mean, strange windows, big windows, little windows, funny-shaped windows. So David designed the whole cabin around the windows, including, like, there's a little tiny window at the floor for the cat to look out. And, you know, it's just kind of weird, strange kind of things, you know? The other thing is that the Keels like to sail and have this wonderful little wood sailboat in the lake. And so he makes the whole interior look like the inside of a wooden sailboat. So it's just plywood floors, plywood walls, plywood ceilings. And this house starts up at the high point and just sticks out into the trees. And you really feel when you're in it like you're in a boat floating out in the foliage. Because by the time you come to the end, you're like 35 feet in the air. You're way up there, and it just comes from him letting the slope go down and sticking way out. So, again, this is actually a really low-cost building, but it's, again, reflected the idiosyncratic aspects of the client. And you know, I wasn't sure I liked it when I first saw it because of all the strange windows. But then when I heard the story about it, all of the strangeness of the window placements made sense. We were just talking about Bayfield before, and there's a couple who have actually commissioned David to do a few buildings, the Andersons. And this is a house that's in the historic part of Bayfield, and so it needed to have a gable roof and be painted white, and there's a little garage at the front, you go back. And it all looks really normal until you get up to it. And it, I mean, we all read Alice in Wonderland, right? And this quality of Alice in Wonderland where Alice drinks the potion and eats the cake, and she gets really big, and then she gets really small. And this phenomenon that we all felt as kids, where we're in this world of like giants, adults, right? And everything is big. And so the scale of everything is kind of odd when we're little kids. Things are too high for us. And so in this house, everything looks too big. So he has a stair up to the front door, and it's about, 15 feet wide. It's huge. It's this enormous stair. It's like a little amphitheater. And people gather, the family gathers on the stairs. And then he does things like inside, he takes a big dining room table and he sawed the legs off to make a coffee table. But he sawed them off at such a level that it's kind of high. So you feel like a little kid with the coffee table like being a little too high. But, so he plays this game of the windows are really big. Some of the chairs are really big. And so he makes you feel a bit like Alice in Alice in Wonderland, where the scale seems a little peculiar, even though it's totally normal in every other way. And so it's a funny feeling. But again, his sense of humor is that he plays with your expectations. And one of the things David likes to say is he likes to lure people into his work by, when you first look at it, it looks normal. And so he's, oh, that's a nice house. I'll go look at that. And then when he gets you inside, he does something that you don't expect. And then he makes you think about things like, well, how big am I? And how big should things be? And it's that constant sort of playing with expectations. He's done a couple houses in here that he's done for his doctor and his dentist. The Deloyas are his dentist, and then David and Judy Arvold are David's his doctor. And so in these two houses, I sort of think and talk about how the houses are reflections of the way doctors and dentists work and the way they think. So the Deloya house was an existing Cape Cod house that they had David make changes to, add on to, and what have you. And he kept talking about how he wanted to do it so that you would make these changes to the house and you wouldn't even notice the changes had been made. And I realized it's kind of what dentists do, They want to cap your teeth, but you don't really want to notice that the dentist was there, So I realized that he was just doing what dentists do, which is it had a nice smile and you never knew that the dentist was there. And so David's additions look totally as if were always there, like a good set of teeth. And meanwhile, the Arvolds, his doctor, was really into, of course, the way the body works. And so David puts, this otherwise very kind of normal-looking white gable-roofed house overlooking the lake in Duluth. And you come in, and there's this huge, basically a big fireplace in the middle of the house that almost looks, the fire's always going. Every time I was there, the fire was going. And it's like the heart of the house. And then David Arvold likes to do carvings, wood carvings, of the body, the body. So he has a series of these carvings along the columns, like human figures. So there's all these sort of references to the body, to the heart beating, the warm heart in the middle of the house, these kind of standing figures. So there's this sense of, there's a lot of qualities about it that have to do with it has all these layers in it, the same way that the body has kind of the layers of skin, and the Arvolds talk about the windows as like eyes out into the world. So the house has all of these kinds of analogies to the human body. And I talk about the fact that that's, in fact, how we think about the places that we live in, that we are always making analogies to ourselves. So a lot of David's houses are kind of proportioned like the human face, the golden section. A lot of them are slightly asymmetrical in the same way our faces are sort of symmetrical, but not really totally symmetrical. There's always a slight difference. So he's always kind of playing with the fact that we are always our own reference back to ourselves and the world here. So let me just, I'll just run through a couple others here, and I'd love to have a conversation with you. He's done some buildings that have these big outside walls. This is a little cabin up in on Madeline Island, which are called Two Black Boxes. It's known on Madeline Island. In fact, there's a little sign that says Two Black Boxes and a little arrow. So everyone knows. David does these black houses, and they strikes a lot of people as odd, why a black house? But, you know, he's Finnish. Finnish American, and you know, there's a long tradition in Finland of these kind of creosoted wood stave churches and barns, there's a long tradition in Finland of black buildings, which look pretty good when it's a lot of snow. There's this material that company whose factory he did makes, which was material for skateboards. Skateboard parks, which is black, and so it very weather resistant, needs no painting, is really cheap, doesn't fade, and so these are extremely inexpensive materials and very low maintenance materials. And meanwhile, you come inside these buildings and they're full of color, and so you think, well, a black building would be dark. But again, what he does is he fools you. He takes you inside and it's full of light. There's lots of windows, and so it's anything but dark. Wonderful kinds of projects here. Another one is for a couple who are doctors in Detroit at Wayne State University, and they had this house, they had a piece of property in northern Michigan, the Yinksts. And they loved fairy tales, and so David makes this house based on a whole set of fairy tales. And you come down a driveway, and there are these four black boxes. A couple of them are garages, one is a guest house, and one is a tool shed. And they kind of sit there, these mysterious black boxes, on this lawn that looks like a big chess set. He's constantly playing these kinds of games with you in terms of, well, it looks kind of like a garage, but it's all black, and then they wanted an outdoor pavilion. So there was a fairy tale about a bug that comes to life, and so he makes it into like a creepy crawly thing that has like crawled out of the woods. And you can sit underneath it and watch the bocce ball and other things going on. Again, he has this sense of humor about things. Why don't I just end with comment about the compounds that he's done. First of all, he himself lives in this compound called the Kluwer Project, which he's designed four houses. And he lives in one and has his office in one. And I kid him because when you sit in his office, all you can see are other David Salmela houses. And I said, David, you've created your own little world here. You don't have to look at anyone else's work. All you see is yourself. But it's true, you know. This couple, the Kluwers, hired him to do their house, and they had extra land, and so they wanted investments, and so they sold off pieces of land to other people with the stipulation that you'll hire David to do the house. And what's interesting to me about it is that you can't tell where the property lines are, is that they share driveways, they share lawns. It's stepping down really steeply and overlooks downtown Duluth, and has this incredible view. The woodshed for the Kluwer's house actually rests up against David's house for support. So it's this idea that they are a kind of a small community of people who share things. And I think that's really significant. This is a photo of his own office where he looks out on his little world. And then finally, I'll just mention Jackson Meadow, which is, if you haven't had a chance to go there, you really should. It's over in Marine and St. Croix, so it's not a far drive from here. And he's done every house in the whole community. And every house has the same sort of rules, has the same sloped gable roof, the same white color, the same dimensions, and every house is completely different. And so he plays this kind of game where, and I talk about that in the article, if you set certain things as fixed, then it gives you infinite amount of room to play with how it all goes together. And so this whole community has been designed by him, and again, everybody feels like they've gotten very distinctive houses, and again, some of them are expensive and very big, and others are very modest. All of this was designed by a landscape architect who did the landscape, Shane Cohn, who he does a lot of work with on a lot of his projects. So it's just, again, a sense of the way in which we tend to think about residential communities as everyone has to look different and every house has to be different. In fact, he's sort of saying, well, in fact, one way to really be different is to not try so hard to look different, but to share a lot of things in common, and that you actually are more of an individual when you also aren't trying so hard to look like an individual. And he makes the observation that that's how people used to live. You'd go into older towns. Not everybody had wacky-looking houses. All their houses kind of looked like they fit in. And that didn't mean they were all the same. They were all different. And so he's trying to make a point about how we should live and could live. So, well, that's a quick rundown, and I skipped a lot. There's a lot more in here. There's all sorts of projects. There's 55 buildings in here, so there's plenty to read. And I tried to make the text as painless as possible, so you would enjoy reading it. But it was great fun to do. So why don't I stop there and see if anyone has any questions, or I can just start signing books. But what do you think of his work?
When I was in the Anderson house, and she said that he helped a lot with the furnishings. Mm-hmm. Does he do that usually?
Yes, he does, although he tends to like Scandinavian modern. So it's sort of like, yeah, you can help with the furnishings as long as we go to Finstyle or one of the Scandinavian stores.
In that house, he had antiques.
He did, yeah, he does. And some of his houses do. The Cotruvo house is full of antiques, and it looks great. You know, so yes, I mean, you know, the thing about David is that, again, a lot of people think, well, you know, architects are control freaks and they're going to give you what they want rather than what you want. But he's not that way at all. I mean, his clients say that, you know, they really feel that they got the house that they wanted, you know. And, you know, he realizes that, and I think part of his success comes from the fact that it's about relationships. So many of his clients will say that when they first commission David, they'll have a 3 or 4 hour conversation. And it's not at all about what they want, it's about them. So he just spends a lot of time getting to know them, and they get to know him. And in every one of these projects, when I would go visit them, you know, the clients were so glad to see David and invite us in. And, you know, we'd just go from having one cup of coffee to the next, you know, because they all view David as their friend, and he views them as his friends. And, you know, that's, I think, the way to be successful in life generally, is to build good relationships with people.
Yes? Given that each of these houses seems so intensely personal, in a lot of ways, what's it like when have very many of his houses been sold yet? I mean, his body of work is not that old.
Yeah.
But I wonder what that will be like.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, not many of the custom houses have been sold, as far as I know. Of course, the Jackson Meadow houses have been. They were built on spec, so they've all been purchased by people that he didn't know. But that's a good point. I mean, it's absolutely true that a lot of these were built for particular individuals, and they have the sort of idiosyncrasies of those people.
And it seems as if someone bought the house and started ripping things out of it, it would be like ripping the soul out of the house.
Right, yeah, that's true, that's true. And I don't know if David has really encountered that yet, but it is a good point. I mean, this is where architecture as an art form is a little different than others. I mean, you don't buy a painting and then rip it up and repaint it or something. You know, you buy the painting and you... But architecture, because it has to function, has a different set of criteria connected to it, and obviously people will change things over time. You know, the thing with David is... You know, I think he'd be fine with that. I mean, you know, he realizes that, as he said, he sees these things as kind of like his children he's sending off into the world. And at a certain point, you can't control things. It'll, you know, what happens to their lives is what happens to them. But it is a good point. And it will be interesting to see how people respond to this work over time. But most of it I found, you know, they're pretty much, I found them very livable buildings. I mean, there's living room, dining rooms, and kitchens, and bedrooms, and bathrooms, and they have all of the pieces that a person would want in a house, for example. So there's not a lot of cause to maybe make a lot of changes to them, I don't know. But he's also this issue of, he's getting to be well known enough, he's probably one of the most awarded Minnesota architects ever, that if people were wise and bought them, they probably would be wise not to change them too much. I mean, moving your furniture and all that, but, you know, radically altering them is probably not a very good thing to do because it probably harms the investment.
But you know, we know there are notable examples in the Twin Cities area of homes built by famous architects that have been demolished.
Yes. Frank Lloyd Wright houses, for example. When they were crazy to do that. I mean, the little house that was demolished, I mean, that house was probably a $3-4 million house. And to demolish it was just...
Which is an interesting other side to the individuality kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, that these are very personal, right, individual homes. Someone else buys it and loves the site and decides they want their own personal individual home.
And that just is the way it is, you know. Ralph Rapson, who was my predecessor at the college, I mean, he's seen the Pillsbury House was demolished, you know, the Guthrie Theater was demolished, and so I don't know quite why we do this, but people do, and it's too bad. But architects recognize that that's just part of it, you know. So, but it's a good point. Interesting to see what will happen over time.
The Metropolitan Building was demolished in downtown Minneapolis.
It was one of our best buildings. Incredible. Yeah, we look back on that and we wonder, what were we thinking? You know, and you know, the thing is that had we kept those things, they would be so valuable now. I mean, the Metropolitan Building would be the place everyone would want to have an office. So it's just a matter of we move too quickly on these things. We should slow down a little bit and appreciate what we have. So well, appreciate your interest in this work, and you know, I think that one of the other things I didn't mention about David, and it's kind of funny coming from a dean of a college, but he never went to architecture school. In fact, he never went to college. He graduated from high school and started working. And, you know, he was kind of a poor farm boy who, you know, basically is self-taught. And yet, you know, in a way, I think there's some advantages to that. I know I shouldn't be saying that here in the university, but there, you know, it kind of liberated him at one level to think for himself. But at a, yes, go ahead. Yeah, but also I think he's almost overcompensated for his lack of education. I mean, you go to his office, he's got books about architecture from all over the world. He's kind of voraciously absorbs all of this stuff all the time. It's so, in a way, I think he's viewed his whole life as kind of his education. And so that's interesting. He's somebody who really loves education because he knows he lacks a lot of it formally. And there's probably a lesson there for all of us, too. Well, when you think of it, I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright never went to architecture school. The famous modern French architect Le Corbusier never went to architecture school. David Salmelin never went to architecture school. And it's like, wait a minute here. Should we be taking a lesson here about that? It's true. I mean, it was pretty controversial when a few decades ago they required that you had to come to a school like ours and get an accredited degree in order to get licensed. And you know, the profession said, well, you know, you have to go to med school to become a doctor, and you have to go to law school to become a lawyer, you know. So on one hand, it made sense, but on the other hand, there is a quality of some of these people that there's a certain level of just inherent talent they have that is probably inborn in them, and they've done just fine without that. Now, maybe most people can't do that and have to, you know, have to get the benefits of a formal education to do that. But there are those few, the David Salmelins and the Frank Lloyd Wrights of the world, who probably no school could ever have handled them anyway. You know? And one of the other things, which is funny, I was thinking about what will happen with David's buildings over time. You know, there's a whole, he has a lot of kids, and two of them are in our school right now. Kai Salmela is studying to be an architect, and Britt Salmela, his daughter, is studying to be a landscape architect. So there'll be plenty of Salmelas off into the future. So if somebody wants to buy a house and modify it, well, they should just hire one of the Salmela offspring to work on it. So that's a good thing, I think. It'll be fun. He also basically runs almost a one-person operation. He works pretty much by himself up in Duluth, and Gladys, his wife, does the bookkeeping, and occasionally he has help from Tia Salmela, who's also a designer down in the Twin Cities, help. But it's kind of amazing when you see the volume of work he does that one person can turn out. So, well, thank you, and appreciate you coming.